Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. Today we're going to be talking with Paul Greenberg, one of my favorite writers in the lexicon of food writers, but really just a great writer overall. Paul, in case you don't know him, is the James Beard Award-winning author and essayist. He wrote the best-selling Four Fish that came out a few years ago. And since 2005, he has been writing regularly for the New York Times, for Food and Wine, Civil Eats, and so many other publications. I honestly can't even list them here. But his focus is always on fish, aquaculture, and the future of our oceans and waterways. And today we're going to talk about his new book, American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Penguin Press published this a few months ago. Welcome to the show again, Paul. I really appreciate you coming on today. I know you've been making the rounds.
Yeah, it's seen a lot of fish, let's just say.
Yeah. I'm just pissed that I didn't scoop Lenny Lopate on this one or Terry Gross.
Well, yeah, no, it's been an interesting time because, you know, it's the peak of sockeye salmon season.
Yes.
And I've actually been eating a lot of sockeye salmon with a lot of chefs and talking about sockeye salmon.
Yeah, well, you know, no time like the present to be doing
exactly.
that. And
exactly.
I'm assuming, are you going to come to Chefs Collaborative again?
Jury's out. I got to see. I've got 9 symposia I'm supposed to do between now and then. So let's see if I'm still walking by then.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, tell us what's the catch? Why did you write this book in particular?
Well, you know, I grew up fishing and you know, had a little boat, and that was sort of for me there was no distinction between what you ate and what you caught and what was local. It was all your fish. And as I've waded in deeper into the sort of world of international fisheries, Four Fish, the last book, you know, really looked at the domestication of the ocean that's going on that, you know, by such and such a date, probably already passed it actually at this point, more than half of the seafood that we eat will be farmed versus wild.
Right.
Years ago, that wasn't the case. Well, the other thing that I stumbled upon after finishing that book was this other very large statistic, which is that more than 85% of the seafood Americans eat is coming to us from abroad, is imported. But meanwhile, about 3 billion pounds of what we catch, which frankly would actually be enough to satisfy the per capita demand of seafood in this country, but 3 billion pounds is exported. So that,
crazy,
to me is the catch. It's like we're sending abroad all this really nice wild high omega-3 fish, and in return, we're getting largely farmed product, often from Asia. So to me, that was worth breaking down.
Absolutely. And Paul, let me just ask you this. Did you get a sense of what kind of numbers we're talking about in terms of gross domestic product? You know, because like the, you know, cattle or the livestock industry accounts for 6% roughly of our GDP. What does fish, how much does fish represent?
Well, I mean, you're talking, you know, several billion dollars. We catch about 9 billion pounds a year, and 3 billion pounds of it is exported.
Wow.
And, you know, it depends how you max, you know, how you calculate the dollar figure, but it's much smaller. I mean, better way to express it is in terms of our overall diet.
Mm-hmm.
We eat about 200 pounds of what I call land food, you know, beef, poultry, pig. 200 pounds of that a year, but we only eat about 15 pounds of seafood. So you can more or less extrapolate value from that. It's a tiny part of the American diet, and I think actually to our detriment, it's a tiny part of our diet.
Oh, I think that's been proven pretty conclusively, actually.
Yeah.
Right? But tell us, so describe the evolution of this devil's bargain we've made with selling all of our wild catch and meanwhile buying in this lesser quality, inferior farmed product, which, as you point out, has a much lower nutritional profile.
Yeah. Well, as far as the export market, we've always been exporters. We always like to export fish. And, you know, if you've read Mark Kurlansky's Cod, you know, you understand that codfish, for example, was one of the key components of triangular trade that allowed, you know, all this, you know, different stuff to move around the world. And, in fact, New York City, up until, like, 1920 or so, was a net exporter of oysters produced in New York City waters. So we are no strangers to sending fish abroad. What has changed in the last, I would say, 30 or 40 years has been the rise of aquaculture in Asia, particularly. Shrimp, tilapia, Pangasius catfish, these are all headliner creatures that are now within the top six fish or seafoods that Americans consume, and mostly they're farmed, and mostly they're coming to us from abroad. So that's a huge swath of it at this point.
Yeah, and there's really no way to address sort of some of the regulatory issues. I mean, we don't really go over and inspect how they are raising their farmed fish in other countries, particularly in Asia, do we?
No, I mean, we're, you know, the FDA says that they inspect about 2% or a little less than 2% of all the seafood that comes into this country. And, you know, they claim that that's a sufficient amount because they have algorithms that, you know, if a shipment or if a, you know, meets a certain profile, it gets flagged. And that very may well be true. But my experience, you know, in being in Vietnam and looking at the just incredible size of the industry and, you know, Asian countries should be complimented on the ability to produce that much protein. But on the other hand, Thailand, which is the largest producer of shrimp for us, they I had always been told by different certifying agencies that if you're going to buy shrimp from abroad, you should buy it from Thailand. Well, this year, we found out that two things. First of all, a disease called early mortality syndrome, which you know, if you're over 40, that strikes heart, you know, fear in your heart. But it does, early mortality syndrome does not affect humans, but it does affect shrimp.
Right.
And it's been sweeping through Asia. And last year, Thailand lost over $1 billion in shrimp crop. The other thing is that, as you might have seen in The Guardian, there was a story came out recently that a certain percentage of the labor used to catch the so-called trash fish that are then ground up and fed to these Asian shrimp farms, but particularly in Thailand, a certain percentage of that labor appears to be slaves. So, you know, it's kind of shocking and, you know, something to consider in the overall kind of quality coming across our gunnels. You know, then the last thing which I'll say is that there are, of course, very good producers of shrimp and tilapia and pangasius in Asia, but there are tens of thousands of them just in Thailand alone. So it's very hard to really get a bead on the regulatory system. And if you have a system that's already allowing slave labor, what does that say about other aspects of it?
You know, absolutely.
Food safety and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what you were, I mean, one of the things that struck me in reading your book, actually, about, you know, when I was looking at some of these issues about labor disputes and the cost of labor being so much cheaper in Asia than it is here, obviously. That's one reason why we love our cheap fish. And just as we love our cheap meat, you know, it's like we are really, I mean, it really is a devil's bargain because here we are, we're always looking to cut those costs, whether it's because you're running a franchise like Red Lobster or Long John Silver's, or whether you're just a consumer who wants a bargain. And what you end up buying is something that not only perpetuates unappealing practices like slavery, but also just kind of overall degrades our sense of what this food system should be. And the other thing that really struck me about this was that the parallel with the shrimp die-off that you just described, and other diseases that are specific to one particular breed or strain of a species is it's also, again, very similar to whether it's a crop like potatoes or whether it's a livestock breed, you know. You monocropping you do at your peril, clearly.
That's right. And you would think that
somebody would have figured this out now.
No, and you know, you would think, because with aquaculture, you know, it's still a relatively new thing. You know, they speak of it as the blue revolution, and it really only started getting going in the 50s and 60s and really blossomed in the 70s and 80s. And you would think, having some of the lessons of land food, they would have learned some of those lessons. But unfortunately, while there are certainly good examples of good aquaculturists, there does seem there's always this downward pressure, price pressure,
right.
that you know puts things that should be not so commodity-like, but puts them into the commodities mold. And you know, as you say, it's done at our peril, and then we have to figure out how to undo what we've done.
Yeah, and how to wean the American public and really the world, but I mean the American public off of this, you know, absurdly cheap food, which is not so cheap, as it turns out.
Well, no, and you know what's interesting too is that it's not like we don't produce some very expensive fish.
Yeah, right. Like the sockeye salmon you're talking about.
Yeah, sure. Or you know, you go to the fish market now, and you see these, you know, it's very hard to find a wild fish for under $15 a pound.
Yes.
And that kind of gives the impression, I think, that there's not enough fish out there. But, in fact, we're actually producing a lot of fish, but it's just that these Asian markets, and some markets in Europe as well, are ready to pay much more money than we're ready to pay for it, that they right. understand the value of it from a nutritional point of view and almost from a...
From a gustatory point of view, right?
Yeah, well, certainly from a gustatory point of view, but almost like kind of like there is a wild carries a premium, and, you know, it carries within it this untamperedness that people appreciate, and they particularly appreciate it in countries which don't have a lot of wild left. And I think that's why it has a certain appeal in Asia, which it doesn't have here.
Right. So you're saying that the Asians have overfished just as we overfished our, at least in the Northeast. I know that we overfished our, you know, Georges Bank all along the Northeastern seaboard was really damaged in this, I guess, the 70s. This is sort of when it came on to, because my mother used to write for the University of Rhode Island School of Oceanography.
Oh, yeah?
And she did a ton of work around aquaculture, actually, as it was just in its beginning. She had a newsletter that was regular, that regularly covered that stuff. But I remember her writing a lot about the sort of the problems with Georges Bank and the overfishing and what that would mean for the industry going forward. And it has really never been totally resolved, to my knowledge, although Catch Shares, I think the new program Catch Shares seems to be working pretty well. I don't know if you follow that.
I mean, the thing is that it's actually interesting to look at aquaculture and overfishing and exporting all as one kind of beast of a seafood system. It's interesting to look back and see what caused us to get into this overfishing dilemma in the first place. You know, the United States controls more ocean than any country on Earth, something like 2.8 billion acres.
Incredible.
But it's a lot. But, you know, again, 85% of our seafood imported. But how we came to control all that water was really kind of a political sleight of hand. Mm-hmm. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, nations were making grabs to control more ocean, and finally... the United States unilaterally declared a 200-mile limit, up to 200 miles, of what would become an exclusive economic zone.
That's the Magnuson-Stevens Act, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people think that that was done, you know, just so that we could get our hands on more fish. And partially it was, but it was also a territorial thing. Like, you know, after World War II, there's a certain hawkish part of the population that wanted to have a greater buffer between us and our enemies. And once we decided we were going to declare this exclusive economic zone, suddenly people were like, well, we better get some people out on that water to control it. And the easiest thing to do was to put fishermen out there.
Uh-huh.
So all of the subsidizing of fishing...
Oh, interesting, Paul. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and so a lot of the fishing the subsidies that went on in the 70s and 80s, you know, there was incredible deals for fishermen in the 80s. You know, you could amortize the value of your boat very quickly so you could get a new boat. So you see this tremendous buildup of American fishing effort. And, you know, surprise, when you build up fishing effort through subsidies, you're going to get overfishing. And so we're largely recovering from that. And as you point out, Georges Bank is still depleted as far as groundfish is concerned, Gulf of Maine. But at the same time, what's happening really in the seafood system is that you have these shortcomings still in the Northeast, and what's filling the shortcomings is a combination of Alaska, and Alaska still has incredibly abundant fisheries, really, really good stuff, and aquaculture product from Asia. But what's interesting is that, you know, Alaska has enough seafood right now to supply Americans with pretty much all the seafood they would need.
And it's wild.
And it's wild. And we're sending, meanwhile, 80% of our wild salmon catch we send abroad.
Right.
600 million pounds of pollock we send abroad. In return, we get catfish, Pangasius catfish and tilapia and shrimp.
Right. And a lot of that pollock, for example, goes away and then comes back as sort of an added value product, like crablet, you know, like that, you know, those famous sea legs that they use in cheap sushi and stuff like that. I mean, isn't that also, aren't we like selling it and then buying it back?
Yeah.
To pollock, a certain extent as well.
Pollock is very much part of this sort of, you know, food masher over in Asia, where a certain portion of the pollock goes over there. It'll be frozen at sea. Mm-hmm. In the Bering Sea, taken to Asia, defrosted, processed, refrozen, and sent back to us.
Brilliant.
And that's, you know, the Asian stuff is mostly that we're getting is fish sticks, prepared fillets, things like that. The surimi, that's the product that you're referring to before, the sort of fake crab in your California roll, a lot of that, oddly, is getting processed in Germany and the Netherlands.
No kidding.
I haven't been to a surimi factory yet, but I'd like to see it. I'm sure it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to take this back just quickly to sort of the beginning of the book, where you have, you know, your book is divided into three sort of main parts. One is about oysters, one is about shrimp, and one is about salmon. And they were, I mean, by the way, I don't know if I've told you how very delightful your book is.
Oh, thank you.
No, really. I mean, not only is it very informative, but you have the most charming and engaging writing style. It was
it was
a delight to read. It really
was. Talk to my partner. She doesn't always find me that charming and engaging, but. I'm just going to patch her in right now if we could.
Yes, do.
So she can hear firsthand. So the book's broken up into three parts. And, you know, it's funny because many people have come out this book in funny ways. I was actually having coffee with Michael Pollan out in Berkeley.
Oh, yeah. Just drop a name there, Paul.
But it was an interesting point because, you know, he is, you know, I was joking with him that he sells as many books relative to me as Americans eat meat relative to fish.
I like that analogy.
So that kind of works. But it was funny, you know, so he and I were talking about how you write a book and then what happens with the book, what the one or two phrases that get picked up in the media and transmitted. And the thing that really got picked up in this book was the whole double frozen issue. You know, the fact that so much, like 80% of our salmon is going abroad and getting frozen first, sent over to China, defrosted, bone, and sent back. And I was like saying to Michael, like, you know, I don't understand why they're clutching onto that so much. And he said, well, you know, it's just a symptom of the larger picture that you're trying to paint. And the picture that I was really trying to paint was the loss of both ecological and economic seafood infrastructure.
Yeah.
And, you know, so once he said that, I kind of was like, yeah, maybe that's true. Getting back to the structure of the book is really a lot about the devaluing and loss of the ecological infrastructure that underpins it. So I do break it up into three parts. The first part is about oysters in the east, shrimp in the Gulf, and then salmon, sockeye salmon in Alaska.
Yeah. And then the oyster, so the oyster thing that, you know, and I think a lot of people at this point know that, you know, the waters of New York were literally paved with oysters, and you could buy oysters for a penny apiece, and every cart, every street corner had an oyster cart. But what I think that people are less aware of is the impact of what you called oyster texture.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could just, you know, unpack that for a second and tell people what it really means to have lost that oyster culture, not only as a gustatory thing, but as an environmental issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, oyster texture, technically, that's a term that was coined by a landscape architect who's in the book named Kate Orff. And you can actually Google it and find her TED Talk. But broadly, I suppose you could say that oyster texture existed before Kate Orff in the form of wild oyster reefs that used to really dominate coastal ecosystems, not just in New York City, but, you know, the equivalent of the Amtrak corridor. I was taking the train from Washington to Boston the other day, and just noting that every city I was passing by was a former oyster estuary. And so oysters build in three dimensions, unlike most bivalves. And what that means is that an oyster dies, another oyster sets on the shell, it grows, another one grows on it. And before you know it, you can have oyster reefs, you know, that are tens of feet, if not dozens of feet high.
Wow.
And these act as near-shore baffles. They're undulated a lot of times, so that when wave action comes in over them, tidal action comes over them, the roughness and the undulation of those reefs break up wave action and can actually serve as storm protection. And in a way, you know, life, it's funny how life imitates itself, no matter who's doing it, whether it's people doing it or whether it's oysters doing it. So the way nature does it, oysters build the equivalent of a natural seawall in front of the near shore, breaking up wave energy, making it so that other things further upland can grow. And that's where you start to get salt marsh, which is another great ecosystem. It's actually the most productive ecosystem on the planet in terms of sheer amount of food energy per acre produced, and it sequesters more carbon than any other ecosystem on Earth. And surprise, we've lost 60 to 70% of our salt marsh in this country. So all those things working together, the oysters at the leading edge, marsh grasses behind it, create this very dynamic ecosystem that is productive of life and protective of life. So that's, to me, what really made me want to focus in on oysters. And and also, you know, it was an interesting opportunity. I mean, I think some of your listenership, particularly in Brooklyn, knows about some of the work that the New York Harbor School is doing to restore oysters. And I, you know, went scuba diving with them and have been sort of tracking their progress throughout the New York Bight. And that's very exciting. I think, you know, I often have been, you know, the phrase, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, is in my head. And I feel like if oysters can be restored to New York City, they could be restored everywhere, and it would be great for coastal protection, but it would also be great for seafood.
Yeah. Well, it would certainly beat the hell out of building a $1 billion seawall. That is, I mean, I can't get over the foolishness of, you know, the powers that be, but I guess somebody's going to get a payoff with that. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's going to create jobs.
It's
going to, you know, some politician can run on it. And
and also the other thing is that, you know, about seafood is that wild seafood, the benefits it bestows and the profits that it gives you are diffuse.
Yeah.
Whereas political and investment opportunities are the opposite of diffuse. You know, they're concentrated, and that's why they
can
get
visible. Yeah,
you know, investors, politicians behind them, and so that was kind of the story that I saw again and again, was that the diffuse value, the diffuse very good value of seafood, undermined again and again by extractive and polluting industries that had few beneficiaries, but who benefited quite a bit, and who had the sort of skullduggery to pursue their agendas.
Well, I think we'll take a short break here, because when we come back, we can talk about that skullduggery in regards to the British Petroleum spill in the Gulf of Mexico and the impact of that on the shrimp.
Yeah.
So stay with us, folks, with Paul Greenberg. We're talking American Catch, and we'll be right back after this sponsor drop.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Hey, my name's Edward Lee, and I'm the chef at 610 Magnolia in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Right on, Edward Lee. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. On the line with me today is Paul Greenberg, author of the newly published American Catch. And we were just talking about skullduggery and how industry has managed to undermine sort of the basic basic economic attractions of seafood by showing a more robust, theoretically a more robust and certainly more visible return on the dollar. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the impact of the British Petroleum spill in the Gulf of Mexico on an aquatic and ecosystem that has thrived for centuries and provided us with incredible food. And somehow we pulled down our pants and let the energy industry have its way with our with our seafood. And let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and I should say, you know, it's a national problem, and it doesn't involve the petroleum industry. There's a great book that's worth your readership reading called Tom's River that's about the Sibagaigi pollution of the portions of the New York Bight. So it's a very similar story. But in the case of the Louisiana Delta, the Mississippi Delta, this is among certainly the largest marshlands in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's an incredibly abundant ecosystem. Louisiana still, after everything that's been thrown against it, Louisiana is still by far the largest seafood producer in the continental United States.
Wow.
And a lot of it is a result of the salt marsh. The salt marsh that is the Mississippi Delta allows creatures to either spawn or to rear in all mm-hmm. the little nooks and crannies of grasses. And something like 70% of Gulf seafood, northern Gulf seafood, relies on that marsh for a portion of its existence. Now, the bad news is that that marsh is now disappearing at a rate of about a football field an hour.
Incredible.
A very, very, very serious problem. And, so this actually, what you had asked earlier, what was the genesis of this book? And there were several genesis, I suppose, but one of them was that initially I'd sold the book as an oil spill book. When Four Fish came out in 2010, the oil spill just happened, and I often like to say that I'm the only person who benefited from the Gulf oil spill, because when Four Fish came out, everybody wanted to talk about the oil spill, or they wanted to talk about the ocean, and I was the nearest book at hand, so I often found myself talking to people like Terry Gross about the oil spill, when meanwhile, I'd really never spent much time in Louisiana at all. So soon after, I sold this book called it, Beneath or Below the Horizon. Remember that was the BP Horizon rig. And there were all these, I was really, my publishers are excited, oh, yes, you're going to write the authoritative book about the oil spill. The book sold, I got my contract, I got ready to go down to the Gulf, and then all of a sudden, all these oil spill books came out. There was Under the Horizon, Over the Horizon, Beyond the Horizon, Shadows on the Gulf, Death on the Gulf, Sea in Flames.
Yeah.
It was just endless, endless, endless. And I ran into my friend Carl Safina, who's big ocean guy, and he had just written A Sea in Flames, this book about the spill. And I said, Carl, I'm supposed to write a book about the oil spill. And he said, don't do it. Don't do it. He said, all the scientists are caught up in litigation. Nobody's going to, nobody's going to know what really happened for years and years. Don't do it. Well, meanwhile, I had already scheduled this trip to Louisiana, and I went out with a shrimper in the middle of the night, and we were talking about the oil spill, and, I was there to talk about the oil spill, and he was there to tell me about the oil spill. And at a certain point, we just sort of ran out of things to talk about.
Yeah.
And it suddenly really occurred to me that this really wasn't the issue. That the real issue was, A, the dissolution of the Louisiana marsh, which allows all the of our shrimp to exist in the first place. And that is in part from the oil industry, but it's not from the spill. It's from, almost a century of development in the Delta. And then the other aspect of it was foreign imported shrimp overturning the market.
Yeah. So they're because our shrimp cost more to produce and their shrimp are cheaper.
Well, it's a wild product, and it is. It's very expensive to trawl shrimp. It's a lot of fuel is involved, and what happened starting in the 40s and 50s and 60s was this biotech revolution around shrimp. It started actually in Japan. A guy named Motosaku Fujinaga was the first to domesticate something called a karuma prawn, and this was a shrimp that was generally used in a dish called dancing shrimp.
Oh, you described that. It was a wonderful thing, yeah.
Yeah, so the dancing shrimp is this shrimp. It's you take a karuma prawn, you rip off its carapace, while it's still alive, you dunk it in sake, and you eat it while it's still sort of wriggling in your mouth.
Mm.
So that was the first shrimp to really be industrially domesticated. And Fujinaga then trained a lot of graduate students who fanned out all over Southeast Asia and would go on to tame the tiger prawn, and then eventually we got the white-leg shrimp. And now the white-leg shrimp, which is from the Pacific, accounts for 80% of shrimp consumed in the United States at this point.
Right.
Almost all of this.
And not our Louisiana brown.
Right, and Louisiana brown shrimp, which is the shrimp that I really focused in on the book, at least in the first part of the chapter, really is just got sort of looped into the commodities chain. I mean, while the Louisiana brown has a very specific taste, as does the Gulf white shrimp, as does the pink shrimp down there, they're each a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
For the public, they're just shrimp.
Right.
And they get sort of funneled into this price point that really doesn't give one product significant value over the other. So that was that. So that was one aspect. But as I said, the other thing is the fact that the Louisiana marshes are disappearing at a rate of a football field an hour. And that happened as a result of not of an oil spill, but in the early days of oil development in Louisiana Delta, it was found to be more efficient to cut shipping channels through the marsh so that you could get a barge to the refinery without having to kind of go on a goose chase to find your port. But also, huge amounts of pipeline were laid beneath the marsh. When you cut into a marsh, you allow salt water to penetrate into places that had traditionally been more brackish or even fresh.
Right.
Once the roots of those plants get exposed to that salt water, they die. And when they die, they don't hold the soil anymore. And then you start to see the whole thing slip away.
Right.
Which is, in fact, what's happening right now.
Incredible. And the other thing that is having a tremendous impact on the Delta is something you and I talked about a year ago when you wrote the article about how agricultural runoff is affecting the Mississippi. Why don't we just give us a little thumbnail of that, too, because that's a major issue.
The Mississippi, of course, is the very heartland of American agriculture, and the Mississippi used to have a floodplain several hundred miles wide. And when you think about it, if you look at one of those topographical maps of the United States, you'll see that Mississippi drains both the Rockies and the Appalachians. So it's just a huge, huge watershed. In the course of the last 150 years, we've gradually been straightening the Mississippi River, pinching it into a kind of perched river situation, making it run much faster than it used to run.
Uh-huh.
Used to be all sorts of nutrients that would have gone into the river would have settled out and fertilized the bottom of the river, allowed all sorts of nice ecosystem benefits to occur. But no, that's not what is now the case. And then add to that industrial development, I'm sorry, agricultural development of an industrial nature throughout the Mississippi plant watershed. And you have tremendous influxes of nitrogen and phosphorus going into the Mississippi. They don't settle out because the river's going too fast. They get shot out into the Gulf of Mexico, where they fertilize algae. The algae blooms, dies, gets consumed by bacteria. Oxygen gets sucked out, and that's where you get the famous dead zone that we hear so much about, and that is in full swing right now.
And that's pretty much what happened in the Chesapeake as well, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, the Chesapeake has different hydrodynamics. It's not like one river that's driving the whole thing.
Right.
But, you know, you do have a lot of agriculture. You do have a lot of nutrient loading. And now, actually, interestingly, a year or two ago, they established in the Chesapeake what's called a total maximum daily load, TMDL, of nutrients that can be put into the watershed. It's a very noble goal. To try and put a number on that. And in fact, it's actually the unfinished business of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act was really supposed to limit or even end the discharge of pollution into our waterways. Agriculture kind of got a nod and an opt-out for a lot of the time of the Clean Water Act.
Yeah.
And so it's been the sort of unfinished business to deal with nitrogen and phosphorus as a product, these so-called non-point sources. The first things that the Clean Water Act really dealt with was point sources, factories, places where you could send an inspector and say, there's something wrong with your effluent here. But with, agriculture, which is so much more diffuse, it's really hard to kind of trace it back to the person who is doing the problem.
Sure.
Anyway, that's a long dog leg by way of saying that we are, in a sense, trading seafood for land food.
Yeah.
We're making the near shore much more hospitable to growing land food crops and making our near shore less productive of seafood, which I think is actually to the detriment of our health and to the detriment of the health of the country at large.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Food security, all that stuff. And your dog leg, by the way, takes us along to your next point in the book, which was the impending pebble mine copper exploration that is going on up in Alaska at the head of the Bristol Bay waters, where we have the greatest sockeye salmon run in the world, right?
In the world. That's
so,
right. Yes.
Let's unpack that for just a second, because you got to testify in front of Supreme Court about this and everything, right?
I testified actually in the Senate about genetically modified salmon, and then I appeared at the Supreme Court at a reception that was put together, which included Sandra Day O'Connor, which is fairly interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
She turns out to be actually a big fisherman, which, you know, I think I say in the book that fishermen are like moles that are planted throughout the political system. And they needn't be Democrats nor Republicans. They just are fishermen first and foremost. And if you're a fisherman, you know, you can vote whatever way you're going to vote, but if somebody starts messing with your fish, that's when you start to get up in arms.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but anyway, so Tumble Mine, I decided that was the third piece in the infrastructure puzzle. You know, if oyster reefs really represent, you know, this incredible in-the-water infrastructure that was very important for seafood, if shrimp really represent the importance of salt marsh and what that does, salmon really represent stuff upriver, the hydrology that allows energy to flow between land and sea. And, you know, if you take a step back from Pebble Mine and what's going on up in Alaska, there's a slide that I often show when I do a PowerPoint presentation of the state of Connecticut, and it's a, you know, just the outline of the state, and then there are 3,000-odd dots on that map. And there's usually a pause, and I say, you know, do you know what all these dots are? They're actually dams, every single dot on this map. There are over 3,000 dams in the state of Connecticut. And I often say this is why people in Connecticut are so uptight, because their chi is blocked.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so that's the way we've reworked the hydrology of the entire country. Dams here, dams there, reworking, industrialization. And what's striking when you go to Alaska, particularly to Bristol Bay, is you don't see any of that. You know, you still see, it's like going back in time.
Wow.
And you see a fully functioning interface between land and sea and the energy that it transmits. And the energy that it transmits is formidable. You know, there are over 40 million sockeye can come into that system every year, and that's just in Bristol Bay. And the lake that connects the land with the sea, Lake Iliamna, at any one time might contain a billion salmon of different sizes.
Good Lord.
So, and all of this, of course, is in the footprint of what would be the largest copper and gold mine in the country. Right now, so, you know, it's been on the, you know, in people's minds for about 20 years, the idea that this incredibly large copper and gold deposit, which is somewhere in the order of $300 to $500 billion worth of metals, happens to be adjacent to this last great sockeye salmon run. And, you know, to get at all of that ore, you would have to extract 10 billion tons of ore. You'd have to sift through it, and the percentages of the ore, I think, are somewhere in the, you know, less, you know, the single digits of all of that 10 billion tons.
Yeah.
So you have to, you know, take out the ore, then what do you do with 10 billion tons of tailings? There's actually nothing
all
you can do with it.
All treated with chemicals.
They'll have mining waste, but, you know, importantly, the actual native soil of the area is sulfurous. As I think Rick Halford, who's in the book, he's like a Republican senator,
who's
state senator, who's kind of become a very anti-Pebble Mine guy, but he was saying to me that if you were to describe the mine, but what it really is, it's a sulfur mine,
not a copper mine, yeah.
So there's so much sulfur in there, and once you expose that to air and water, it can become dangerous and damaging to fisheries, not to mention copper itself. Copper in very small concentrations, when it gets into watersheds, confuses fish or salmon, and it can impede their ability to migrate. And in fact, actually, oftentimes people attribute the decline in salmonids, you know, trouts and salmons, in a lot of the country, even those that don't have connections to the ocean, but they attribute it to copper that's gotten into the water either through mining, but also through breaks in cars, that when you brake, that you're emitting carbon, the copper into the water. Or into the system, and these little trace amounts of copper are enough to throw off the system.
That is shocking.
So anyway, so you know, this huge mine is, you know, people have been trying to do it for years, and it looked like it was coming to a head. A big partner had been secured in the form of Anglo American PLC, and looked like they were, you know, really going to start applying for permitting. But what's interesting, and why I put this as the sort of conclusion of American Catch, is that fishermen for the first time really seem to kind of get their back up and say enough is enough. And in this case, it was both sport fishermen and commercial fishermen, two sectors that usually detest one another, got very, very, very up in arms about this. Mm-hmm. And now we're at the point where the EPA has started the initial parts of a process called a 404C action. And if that goes through, it would allow the federal government to step in and severely limit the amount of mining that could be done in the area, if not eliminate the possibility altogether. So that's where we're at right now.
Because the 404C is a water protection resolution, isn't it?
It's within the Clean Water Act. Just one of the clauses.
So in other words, amazingly enough, the EPA may actually do something.
Yes, they might. They might.
Jury's out. Hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I mean, I'd heard that the Pebble Partnership is possibly filing suit against the EPA for feeling that, that the EPA had overstepped its jurisdiction by starting the 404C. And the question is, are they going to tangle this up into some kind of litigation that could last for a long time?
Yes.
That would outlast the present administration, which grudgingly seems to be heading towards the direction of protecting Bristol Bay.
Yeah.
So if they wait out this present administration, who's to say, if Ted Cruz or somebody like that comes in, what they're going to feel about this mining project? And it's hard to walk away from $300 billion worth of metals.
Well, I find that those estimates are always kind of inflated. I mean, they were telling people in northern New York about fracking that they were, there was X number, and I happen to know that those natural gas wells, they don't last 10 or 25 years. They last maybe 5.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And probably, this is a similar case of where they over, inflate the numbers and dangle this promise of everybody in Alaska making $1 million. It ain't going
to
happen, And then, there's no cleanup either.
The numbers that I have heard is that there'd be enough work for about 80 years of extraction, and I don't, I'm not a mineralogist, I can't tell you whether that's correct or not, but, nobody's saying it's going to be forever, but they are saying, the studies that were made of the mine and the potential remediation that you would have to do following the opening of the mine, the EPA actually said, that the site would require perpetual remediation.
Yes, you did
say
that
in the
book.
Like forever.
Right.
That you would have to deal with
for the rest of the world. Yeah, the world's history. Until we blow up.
I just find it interesting that, 10,000 years from now, is somebody going to find the document that requires him or her to remediate?
Right.
And what are they going to feel about that?
Exactly.
And the other thing is that the value of the mine, $300 to $500 billion, all well and good, and the salmon is it's orders of magnitude less valuable on a per annum basis, and this gets back to what we were saying earlier about the diffuse nature of fisheries versus the concentrated nature of industry and extraction. So, if the salmon run is worth $300 to $400 million a year, and I should say that's just the fish value, it doesn't include the residuals that some people put more at, like $1.5 billion a year. But all right, let's say for the sake of argument and simplifying the math, it's $300 million for salmon and $300 billion for copper. So it's going to take you, well over 1,000 years to amortize that value and make it equivalent. But
that's okay because you're not spending the perpetuity remediating your
environmental
disaster.
That's right. You could have perpetual salmon. Certainly would choose perpetual salmon.
I would too. Paul, we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about the there were two things, actually, that I really wish we'd gotten to, but maybe that will be another program. But sort of the lack of infrastructure in the production and distribution for some of the smaller fishing fleets, to me, was a real parallel with local agriculture. And the other thing is the consolidation of the seafood industry, which is very similar, again, to the livestock industry. And what does that mean going forward? Can we get a last word on that?
Well, we've lost a lot of shoreside processing, mostly because those shoreside things have become – the shoreside real estate sites have become really valuable. And as a fish processor or a fishing company guy told to me, fish houses are becoming hotels all the time. You never hear of a hotel becoming a fish house.
Yeah.
And that kind of is what is happening to so much potential to process fish locally. It's one of the reasons we're offshoring so much processing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, most of our processing takes place in Asia or in Europe, as you pointed out, in the Netherlands and Germany. Who knew?
Yeah. And that's because, we've lost it. And, I got into this back and forth with the squid industry, welcome to my world, where I did an op-ed in the LA Times about the transshipping of squid, and they were saying, it's actually very not just cost-effective, but actually low carbon to ship stuff to Asia, process it, and send it back. And it is true that when you put stuff on a boat, It actually doesn't cost a lot of energy to ship a frozen product abroad and bring it back.
Huh.
But the issue really to me isn't so much the carbon, you know, although it's, you know, you can talk about food miles and people's ears prick up. But the issue is really about the outsourcing of the infrastructure. Because once you start losing the ability to pay people who are skilled at cutting fish, surprise, in a generation or two, you're not going to have anybody who knows how to cut fish.
Yeah.
And that's a skill. It's an artisan skill. And once you lose that, then you lose your ability to, you know, to process your, you know, you lose your food security.
Yeah.
So food security can be lost on many levels. It can be lost on, you know, actual food being produced, but it's also the people who can turn it from a raw thing into something that you would want to eat.
Yeah. Right. I think that's such a great point and applicable all the way across the spectrum, frankly.
Yeah,
and then there's the whole outsourcing of like selling Smithfield to the Chinese. And we don't have time, unfortunately, to talk about that.
You'll have to have another guest for that show.
I'll have to have, you know, you'll come back and we'll talk about more about the fishing industry and then contrast it to something like that. But just to tell people, you have a website. It is?
Yeah. So my website is just paulgreenberg.org. But people tend to find me more through my Twitter feed, which is the number 4, so 4 Fish Greenberg. And or you can go to facebook.com/4fish. That's spelled out F-O-U-R-F-I-S-H. But I'm happy to respond to people on Twitter and Facebook if they have further questions.
And the name of the new book is The American Catch, or just
American Catch. Yeah. No, The.
American Catch, and it's got a subtitle, Saving Our Local Seafood. What is it? What is your
the
subtitle?
Fight for Our Local
the
Seafood.
The Fight for Our Local Seafood, yeah. Paul, it's been a pleasure. You're a wonderful guest. I really enjoyed this.
Pleasure,
hope I see you at Chef's Collaborative. If I don't, I hope it's not too long before we
talk
again.
Some other collaboration will occur, I'm sure.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Take care.
And thanks to my sponsor, Cane Vineyards. And thanks to my engineer, Jack Hinsley, as always. And I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.